This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and online at kexp.org. Our guest this morning is Robert Glennon, the Morris K. Udall Professor of Law and Public Policy in the Rogers College of Law at the University of Arizona. He is the author of many articles and books, including Water Follies, Groundwater Pumping, and the Fate of America's Fresh Waters. Robert Glennon is here today to tell us about his most recent book, Unquenchable, America's Water Crisis and What to Do About It. Welcome, Robert. Welcome back to the sustainability segment.
Thanks so much, Diane. It's great to be back with you.
What are the major ways we use water in the U.S.?
Well, the major use by extraction is for power generation. Power plants withdraw waters from rivers or lakes and use it then in the cooling system. But most of that water gets returned to the system, so it's not consumptive. The major consumptive use is for agriculture. In most states, farmers use about 80% of that state's water. And a relatively small amount of water is used for municipal and industrial purposes, somewhere between 70 and 10%.
How good is the data on the amount of water used for different purposes?
Well, some of it's pretty good. We have a wonderful science agency, the U.S. Geological Survey. But while they won't speak candidly about it, I'll speak candidly, they're woefully underfunded. Let me give you one very concrete example. Groundwater constitutes one quarter of the entire country's water supply, and yet we spend only $10 million a year collecting data about it. In many places, we don't know how many wells there are, we don't know how much they're pumping because they're not metered, and we don't know the characteristics of the aquifer. So we've really not done a very good job of studying this important resource.
Well, in a sense, you've been alluding to this, but what are some indications that we take water for granted?
Well, we Americans are spoiled. Turn on the tap in the morning and out comes a limitless quantity of high-quality water for less money than we pay for cell phone service or cable television. We Americans think that water is just like air. It's limitless and inexhaustible, when in fact it's quite finite and it is exhaustible.
What are the signs that the availability of water in the U.S. is becoming a major problem?
There are several. If you look at places as disparate as Orem, Tennessee, that ran out of water in 2007, or South Carolina, where a paper factory closed because it couldn't release its flows because there wasn't enough water in the river, or to four different states that have denied permits for power plants because there wasn't enough water to run them, or to Lake Superior, the largest of the Great Lakes, that was too shallow to float fully loaded cargo ships, or to the West Coast in California, where commercial and residential developments have been canceled for lack of water, and where farmers are cutting off the tops of perfectly healthy avocado trees because there's not enough water to irrigate them, and in other sections where sinkholes and earth fissures have opened up, where salt water has intruded the aquifers, where rivers and springs and wetlands have dried up. It covers most parts of the United States, and it's enormously serious.
If water were in very short supply, what would be the implications for our economy?
Well, they're tremendous. We may fret about running out of oil, but water lubricates the American economy just as oil does. And without an abundant quantity of water, all kinds of companies with good-paying jobs will not be able to operate. Let me give you a really concrete example. Intel. They make these incredible chips that run the computer age, and they are a global corporation with revenues of $37 or $38 billion, and they can open up their fabrication facilities any place in the world. Well, we want to make sure that most of those are located right here in the United States, and they use a lot of water. We need to make sure that we have water for those kind of companies.
How does the shortage of water affect the environment?
In a lot of ways. First, because we've taken so much water out of the streams that it's sad to say, but some streams have dried up altogether, like the Rio Grande, the Colorado. Countless springs have dried up from groundwater pumping. Lake levels are low. The result is aquatic species are harmed. Fish are threatened or even extirpated. Dams block the flow of fish. Of course, you folks in the Northwest know very well. So it affects the environment in myriad ways.
Would you give some examples of struggles between states over water?
Sure. One example of an interstate fight is right there in the Pacific Northwest, in the eastern part of Washington, where you're in a bit of a tussle with Idaho over an aquifer there. A little further east, you've got Wyoming fighting the state of Montana. Move south a bit, and you've got Colorado fighting with Nebraska and Kansas. But it's not just a western phenomenon. In the east, you've got Georgia, Florida, and Alabama fighting. You've got North and South Carolina, as we talk, in the Supreme Court, fighting over a river there. In fact, more than 35 of the lower 48 states are fighting with their neighbors over water. And when you resort to litigation, that's a pretty desperate measure.
Would you like to share some examples from your book of some of the outrageous wastes of water?
Well, I think waste is in the eyes of the beholder, of course, but sure, I'd be happy to. Well, some people would look at golf courses, but probably those people aren't golfers. One of my favorites is power showers that are now very much in vogue in Phoenix. And these are made by Kohler and other high-end manufacturers of bathroom fixtures. And one of them, their catalog, is just so delightful. There are 10 shower heads, each producing water with enough force to take the paint off walls. It requires so much water that the plumbers in homes in Phoenix are installing 300-gallon hot water tanks in homes rather than the traditional 140-gallon tank. It's an example of a bit of indulgence. A different area of the country, one that I like a lot, has to do with a theme park in Atlanta called Stone Mountain. It's a park that's been around for a long time. It's kind of the South's answer to Mount Rushmore. They have Confederate war generals carved into stone. And last year, right in the middle of the drought, they partnered with Coca-Cola to bring on board a new part of the theme park that was going to be called Coca-Cola Snow Mountain. And Diane, what this was an outdoor snowmaking project. And the press release that accompanied this said that research had disclosed that Atlanta children had seldom had a good snow experience. You just sort of wonder, like, how long did it take them to do this research to realize that there aren't many snowstorms in Georgia, and that's why Atlanta children haven't had a snow experience? So in the middle of the drought, a little over a year ago, they brought this thing online on a day, Diane, when the temperature hit 81 degrees. And these people are making snow in the midst of a drought.
Would you comment also on the use of water to dispose of human waste?
Sure, I'd be happy to. This is one of my pet peeves. I happen to think it's the biggest waste of water in the United States. It began, innocently enough, as a public health measure in response to cesspools and privy vaults and the like, but it quickly became a real environmental hazard. What happened is that human waste was mixed with water and then dumped into rivers. Now we don't do that directly. We mix the waste into water and then we treat it at treatment plants. But a century ago, Teddy Roosevelt said that a civilized society should be able to figure out something else to do with its waste other than put it in its drinking water. But that, Diane, is exactly what we do in the United States. So then we send the stuff to the treatment plant. They treat it to potable purposes. They send it back to us. It's now all cleaned up. And what do we do with it? We only use 10% of it for cooking and drinking purposes. The rest we flush down our toilets. We send out to our yards for landscaping purposes. So what we're doing is we are spending more than $50 billion a year to treat to potable purposes a huge amount of water when we only use 10% of it for those purposes. So I think it's very, very important that we rethink how we dispose of human waste. And there's a public health aspect to it, too, if I can explain that, which is there are certain emerging contaminants, they're called, personal care products, such as antibiotics, hormone supplements, erectile dysfunction medicines, and on, that millions of Americans take, and they're not fully absorbed by their bodies. They're excreted. They end up in the waste stream, flushed back to the treatment plant, but with conventional treatment processes, they are not removed. Well, then that water is sent back to us, and the scientists have no clue about what the human health consequences are of ingesting a veritable cocktail of these compounds. Now, they're in very small doses, but still, it's quite alarming. So it's time to rethink the American toilet.
I'm Diane Horn, and we are speaking with Robert Glennon, the Morris K. Udall Professor of Law and Public Policy in the Rogers College of Law at the University of Arizona, and author of the book, Unquenchable, America's Water Crisis and What to Do About It. And you are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. What are the key factors driving new demands for water?
The elephant in the room is population growth. A couple of years ago, the United States went over 300 million. And the Census Bureau predicts that by mid-century, so that's only 41 years away, we're going to hit 420 million people. Now, how are we going to get water for an additional 120 million people? That's just staggering to contemplate. And then there are other demands. Some are for things like bottled water. Some are for recreational uses. Some are for new industry. Some are for new lands to be irrigated for farming. So there's a whole range of things that we're doing, and not all of them are silly by any means, but some of them are questionable.
Who regulates or is in charge of water in the U.S.?
That's a great question. Well, there's several different layers to that. At a threshold level, you have water providers, and they are both public and private. Most of us get water from a municipal water department, but about 15% of us get water from a private company that's regulated by the State Public Utility Commission. So they're regulated by the Public Utility Commission. The municipal people are directly regulated by the elected officials, the mayor and council or whatever. You have other water providers who provide farmers through federal agencies. And then you have layers of jurisdiction and layers of authority. You have state laws that regulate water, both state water departments, and usually there's a state quality agency. In your state, you have the Department of Ecology. And then there's a federal overlay through things like the Clean Water Act, and the Safe Drinking Water Act, CERCLA, RCRA, and a variety of other federal regulatory systems.
How does this regulatory system or these systems work? How effective are they?
Well, it sort of depends on which one we're talking about. I think a main message I would like to convey, though, is that they're not talking very well with one another. There are overlapping jurisdictions, sometimes conflicting regulatory opportunities, and the Congress really needs to think about how to streamline the various agencies that have some piece of the regulatory pie, because they're in all kinds of different departments. They're not in one agency under one secretary.
What approaches have we used so far in trying to provide adequate water resources, both now and in the future?
Well, the usual answer is we think that we can engineer our way out of a water problem. So that would mean diverting more water from rivers, so new pipes or diversions, building new dams for storage supplies, or drilling more groundwater wells. We're really overtapping our aquifers. Every year, Diane, an astonishing 800,000 new wells are being drilled in the United States. It's almost completely unregulated. And the consequence of that is that groundwater tables are plummeting and the environment is being hurt because groundwater is intimately connected to surface water and you get lower levels in nearby streams and rivers, lakes, and wetlands. So that era of an engineering mentality of wells, dams, and diversions, that is coming to an end because those just aren't viable with very, very few exceptions. So we need to be thinking about alternatives. And there are some terrific alternatives out there. But the first thing we need to think about is conservation. And this may sound silly, but California is in the middle of a drought, and it hasn't done a very good job with water conservation. So I'd like you to think about Southern California, the Los Angeles area. If you drive around there, you see all kinds of homes, businesses with lush landscaping, lawns, rose bushes, other flowering plants that aren't native. Few people realize, even those who live there, that it's a desert. Los Angeles only gets 15 inches of rain a year. That's barely 3 inches of rain more than we get here in Tucson, Arizona, in the middle of the Sonoran Desert. So Southern California just lives as though it were in a lush environment. It really isn't a lush environment. It depends on imported water. So conservation has got to be the first place to start. But some communities like Tucson, Albuquerque, San Antonio, they've already embarked on pretty aggressive conservation programs, and they still need to find some more water. So what else are we going to do? Well, for coastal communities, in some places, desalination is an option. Not a silver bullet, but it's an option. There are some problems about that we could talk about if we have time. Another thing, though, that is really becoming very evident is reusing our municipal effluent, so-called reclaimed systems. We in Tucson are using quite a bit of reclaimed water to water fairways and golf courses, cemeteries, schoolyard, playgrounds. It has use in some industrial facility applications, some mining applications. And the thing about reclaimed water is as your city grows, so does the supply. So that's a viable option. But in the end, Diane, we need to think outside the box because those possible solutions, even collectively, aren't enough to solve the problem. So what we really need to think about is this. The supply of water is much like a giant milkshake glass, where you have a finite supply and you have each demand being a straw in the glass. What we have done in the past is to let anyone who wants put a new straw in the glass. Well, that's the tragedy of the commons. That's a recipe for disaster. The new era is going to be an era of water reallocation. And by that I mean we must insist that people who want to put a new demand on the public resource persuade someone else to use less water, to pinch someone else's straw and take it out. And I think the best way to do that is to demand that growth pay its own way. Growth retire an existing right to use water in exchange for a new right to use water.
Could you say more and explain what you mean by that?
Sure. I'll give you an example out of Santa Fe. So Santa Fe is, you know, a beautiful town in New Mexico, lovely historic traditions, wonderful art, wonderful cuisine, and they've run out of water. So the city council said, okay, if you want to put a new home in Santa Fe, they did some calculations and they figured, well, if the developer were to retrofit 8 existing homes and take out their high-flow toilets and replace them with low-flow toilets, then that would offset what the developer was doing. So pretty quickly, what happened was a veritable cottage industry. Plumbers went around Santa Fe knocking on doors and saying to people, would you like a new toilet? And they said, sure. So they replaced the old high-use toilets with low-use toilets, showed to the city that this is what they had done, and then sold those credits to the developers. Well, pretty soon, there were no more toilets to retrofit. It worked so successfully. But Santa Fe said, well, you know, we're on to something here. So they said, okay, you're going to still need to bring water to the table if you're a developer. You're going to have to show us that you have a supply adequate for the needs of your development. And to do that, they began buying up some agricultural water rights from farmers who weren't making much money off it. Maybe the field was mostly clay soils, the crop wasn't a particularly profitable crop, and the farmers were more than happy to sell a piece of their water rights to developers. And the developers used those water rights then to secure permission to build. So it was creating a demand that developers pay their own way. Now, that sounds sensible enough, but frankly, Diane, we've not done that in the American West. City councils and boards of supervisors have routinely rubber-stamped new applications for permits without any consideration of whether there was water to supply them.
You are listening to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP 90.3 FM Seattle and on the web at kexp.org. I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Robert Glennon, the Morris K. Udall Professor of Law and Public Policy in the Rogers College of Law at the University of Arizona, and author of the book, Unquenchable, America's Water Crisis and What to Do About It. In your book, you speak about using price signals that create financial incentives to conserve as a way of promoting water conservation. Would you say more about that?
Sure, I'd be happy to. It's one of the things I very strongly believe in. I mentioned a little earlier that we pay less for water than we do for cell phone service or cable TV. In fact, Diane, we don't pay anything for water. Now, that sounds counterintuitive, but what we pay for when we pay our bill to the municipal water department or the private water company is we're paying for the cost of service. We're paying the freight for them having a building with lights and electricity and an accounting department and plumbers who have tools and benefits and can fix our pipes and install them and make sure that everything works right. we're paying that cost. We're not paying for the water. There's no commodity charge for water. In fact, Americans, next to Canadians, pay the lowest of any industrialized society for our water. And there are consequences of this. In many communities around the United States, there are no water meters whatsoever. People just turn on the tap and use whatever they want. And I'm not talking about Michigan, where you may think that they have a lot of water. I'm talking about Fresno, California, Sacramento, California. There are no meters. It's really quite bizarre. In other communities, fully one-third of the United States has a rate structure with declining block rates. So the last unit of water you use, you will pay less for rather than more for. Well, these are very perverse incentives. They don't encourage conservation. They encourage profligate water use. So I think we need to start all over. What we need to do first is to recognize that there's a human right to water, and for everyone, a small quantity of water will be provided, no questions asked. If we, the richest country in the history of the world, can't make that commitment to our people, then we are a sorry lot. So that's the first point. But then after that, we need to have gradually increasing block rates to target discretionary outdoor landscape uses, which is where most of the water goes. If you want to have a swimming pool, I'm not saying you prohibit the person from doing so, but I am saying the person should pay the full cost of that.
To what extent has your approach been tried in various municipalities?
It's right here in Tucson. We add to that a seasonal adjustment. If you think about it, people don't take more showers or cook more meals or flush the toilet more in the summer. What they do is they fill their swimming pools, which then evaporate a lot, and they water their plants. So we have a seasonally adjusted rate base here in Tucson, and it's got increasing block rates, and it sends a conservation message, no doubt about it. It still isn't enough, though, because it is, I don't want to get too technical about this, but it still is revenue neutral. That is, all the money that comes in simply pays the cost of Tucson Water providing the service. I think we should have steeper rates and then use the money that's generated for all kinds of good public purposes.
Would you speak also about the neglect and inadequacy of our current water infrastructure, the pipes and so forth?
Yeah, I sure will. They're in a terrible state of disrepair. Most people who evaluate them give them a grade of D or D minus on a letter grade basis. The estimates to replace them are anywhere from $500 billion to $1 trillion to upgrade the water pipes, the sewer pipes. And in many communities, they're hemorrhaging water. The city of Philadelphia suffers about 800 water pipe breaks a year. Streets get flooded, businesses get flooded, the water gets wasted. And then all of that ends up back through the sewer system in combined storm and sewer water systems back to the treatment plant where it all has to be treated again. So it's in a terrible state of disrepair. And there may be some opportunities to move on this front, especially with Mr. Obama trying to overhaul the infrastructure of the United States. But this is another reason, Diane, why I think it's the exact right moment to rethink what we do with human waste. We surely shouldn't rebuild systems that combine storm water and sewer water in one system. What we should be doing are some of the things you folks in Seattle are doing, which is so-called green infrastructure, which is looking to keep water out of the sewer system, not encouraging it to be in the sewer system. Because once it's in the sewer system, then we have to treat it. So let's figure out a way to use it sensibly and to grow neat things that clean the air, trees and the like, rather than putting it in the storm system.
What do you think most stands in the way of solutions to our water crisis?
Well, I think Americans are ready to join in the battle to face the crisis, but I don't think most people know much about it. And that's, I'll tell you, Diane, enormously frustrating to water managers. I talked with Lester Snow, who's the director of the California Department of Water Resources, and he said, you can't imagine how difficult it is. He said, there was a survey recently in Southern California that asked people, where does the water come from? And most people answered, from the tap. And then when pushed to explain, they said, oh, it comes from a groundwater well down the street. Now, Diane, this is the area of the country, the area of the world, that imports more water than any place else. and most people had no clue that it was imported. So it's a kind of out of sight, out of mind thing. The water managers have managed to keep putting duct tape on the pipe and keep putting other Band-Aids on the problem. People don't want their taps to be sputtering and having nothing coming out of them. And so the problem really has been camouflaged.
Well, what's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
Oh, well, the message is to be optimistic. It's a crisis. There's no question about it. But a crisis is a very different matter than a catastrophe. In a crisis, there's room to move. There are all kinds of options, and I talk about them in the book and give a menu of options. But we need the political will to address the problem. Waters are so critical to us, to our sense of ourselves, our culture, our spirituality. Without water, if you think about doomsday novels, all of those novels are dry and arid and barren. Well, we don't want that. We want the sound and sight and smell of bubbling water and brooks, and we just need to do a better job of understanding how critical water is to our well-being.
Well, thanks so much for being here, Robert.
Oh, it was a pleasure to be back with you, Diane. Thanks for having me on the show.
We have just been speaking with Robert Glennon, the Morris K. Udall Professor of Law and Public Policy in the Rogers College of Law at the University of Arizona, and author of the book, Unquenchable, America's Water Crisis and What to Do About It, published in 2009 by Island Press. For more information, check on the web at rglennon.com. Again, that's rglennon.com. The sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters program you have just heard will be on the streaming archive section of KEXP's website at kexp.org for the next 14 days. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the sustainability segment again next week on 90.3 FM and kexp.org.